Good evening and welcome to this special holiday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, two baseball pioneers speak about racial and religious adversity in the sport. Two Major League Baseball All-Stars, James Mudcat Grant and Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Vern Law, discussed racial and religious adversity in the face of the Ku Klux Klan and other bigots in the game during the 1950s in a University of Idaho School of Journalism and Mass Media panel at the 1912 Center in Moscow, April 15th. All-star pitcher James Mudcat Grant, who in 1961 was the first black pitcher to win more than 20 games in a season, said his time growing up in La Cuchi, Florida, was difficult, especially when the KKK arrived in his town.
La Cuchi, Florida was a lumber mill town. We had two churches in La Cuchi, Florida. And we had a baseball team. That was one of the best things that happened to me. Because every Sunday, we played, either a doubleheader or at least we played one game. The minister of the church was a baseball fan. And my mom at the time wasn't necessarily a baseball fan. She used to watch all the time because instead of playing baseball on Sunday, she wanted me to make sure that I spent time in church. Now, the minister, being a baseball fan, knew that I was a good baseball player. And we worked out a deal that no matter what kind of sermon he was preaching, he would always take a glance at his watch. And around game time, no matter how he was preaching, he would look at me and he would go like that. That was a signal that I was to go to the parsonage and put on my uniform and run down and play a game of baseball. Now, when I got to the baseball park, the fans took over because my mom was very smart. And if she caught me at that baseball game, instead of being in church, then I'm not going to tell you what happened to me, you know. But once I got to the ballpark, the Lumber Mill ballpark, the fans then kept a little cubby hole where if my mom would always come down to see if she could catch me, they had me underneath the stand hidden until she left. At that time. But religion was very important to the children of La Cuchi, Florida. Our strength came from paying attention to the wisdom of the minister and of course those people that pretty much took care of us from a religious standpoint, and the confidence and the less fear that we had because the Ku Klux Klan used to drive through La Cuchi every other Thursday night. And what they would do, you couldn't turn the lights out in the house when they would come through because they knew that if you turn the lights out, they of course knew that we knew that they were coming. And what they would do is that they would shoot through the homes for I would say maybe about 15 or 20 rounds or something like that. And of course, we had a type of trap door where mom would put us underneath the house. But the confidence that we needed was given to us from the church. And we, for some reason, I don't know, we always thought the fact that we were protected from a religious standpoint gave us confidence then and not so much of a fear circumstance. Now, in writing my book, I thought about that a lot. If we didn't have the church, I think that from a psychological standpoint, it would have been very rough at that time. But we always thought that we were protected and that life would be all right one way or another. But it was the church that were fans from a little guy. Finally, I graduated from high school and went on to become a professional baseball player at that time.
Vernon, my cat talks about the community of his church and religious life in Lacoochee. What was the community like for you in Meridian, Idaho?
The next speaker is 1960 Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Vernon Law, who played 16 seasons for the Pittsburgh Pirates, including the 1960 team that defeated the New York Yankees.
Well, we were a bunch of farmers. I was born and raised on a farm, worked hard. My dad saw to that. And if I didn't work hard, why, you're liable to get a strap. I don't know if most of the people around here don't know what a razor strap was, but if you felt it, you had welts on you. So I remember our neighbors, we would have hay days where we would help the farmers next door, and you get paid $1 a day working hard, you know, and that was, I can remember the time when I had 7 silver dollars, and I had those in my hand. I didn't know what to do with them. I gave them to my folks because I didn't need anything. I had clothes. I had food on the table, we didn't go to town. We lived 6 miles from Meridian, so we didn't really do an awful lot except go to church, work, and milk cows, and do the farm work, you know. And so that was my way of growing up. But I was taught to be honest. My parents was very strict about being honest, telling the truth, keep your nose clean, no fighting, no cursing, swearing, no smoking or whatever, and the things that other people did that I knew about. But we were supposed to stay away from tobacco, alcohol, and all those things that, you know, that was harmful to you. We as LDS people feel that our bodies is a temple. And no unclean thing needs to go in that body. You know, of course, we speak of a temple, you know, where people worship and get married in the temple and do other kinds of works. You know, for those of you who are familiar with the LDS faith, while we do temple work for the dead and so forth that have passed on, that didn't have an opportunity to be baptized or be taught the gospel or whatever. So that was my raising up and belief. And I think every athlete should have an anchor of some kind. I had two. I had the church, and of course I had my wife. We've been married for 65 years. I have 31 grandkids. I've got 41 great-grands, and it's been a real blessing to have children that have children, and they're fun. We enjoy them. Life has been good to me, and I appreciate every blessing and opportunity that I've had, you know, to be a major league ball player, to have success in doing that, and I thank God for those kinds of things that's happened in my life, because without them, I don't know what I would have done. I could have gone the other way. You know, I could have had some terrible experiences in my life. Just to give you some idea about that, you know, I can remember in Montreal, I pitched against that team there that was there, and I pitched a good game. We won the game, and I'm usually one of the first ones to get to my room after the game, and I'll get a quick ham and eggs or something, and then go on up and go to bed, get my rest for the next time. Well, I'm asleep and the phone rings. On the other end of the line is a pretty feminine voice that says, "Mr. Law," and I says, "Yes, you pitched a very good game tonight. Thank you, you know." And I hear music in the background, and I know that she's got to be in a bar, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised whether one of my teammates wanted to find out if I was really what I promise, you know, and people know about, you know. And so, anyway, she says, why don't you come down and have a drink? And I says, I don't drink. She says, well, what do you do for fun? And I said, I play baseball. And she says, well, come on down. We'll go for a ride. And I says, ma'am. I says, you know, sweetheart, I'm married. I have two children. I love my wife. I love my kids. No, thank you. I'm going to, you woke me up. I'm going back to sleep. So thank you for your call. And goodbye. So anyway, but those, you know, those experiences come and go. And I had others. I had others where my teammates who were next door, we had connected rooms. I had a big suitcase pushed up against the door. And it must have been 2-3 o'clock in the morning. I hear bang, you know, and my suitcase come down. And I kind of startled me a little bit. And I kind of turn over. And here's this woman standing right by my bed. They had bet her that she could not get in my bed for $50. So, yeah, so, you know, I could have gone that way, you know. But no, you know, I think because of my bringing up, I've made right choices in my life, and I'd suggest that you do the same. Because if you want to experience joy, happiness, security, and trust, honesty, whatever, you know, you practice what you preach or what you've been taught in your life, and I've tried to do that. Thank you. Well, Torsten, I've always been taught, you know, to treat people like you like to be treated, and so when I got to Brooklyn and was asked to pitch, you know, against that team. Jackie was still a good ball player back then. You know, he came up in 47. That's when it really started, you know, with the introduction of Afro-Americans to baseball. And Jackie Robinson was the one who broke that barrier. Branch Rickey told him, right at the very start, you can't. Now, this has come from Branch Rickey's mouth because he became one of our general managers for the Pirates later on. I didn't know him during that time when I was pitching in Brooklyn and when he was there. But he told Jackie Robinson, Jackie, no matter what, you cannot retaliate. You've got to take whatever they give you. And don't retaliate, because if you do, you will close the door for all other African Americans that will be coming in to play after you. And so, you know, that's like, that puts a heavy load on a person's back, you know, when you are told that you can't do something when something very oppressive happens to you. Well, Jackie, when I pitched this, well, when I got there, I didn't start against the Dodgers at that time, but I did pitch against them when my turn came as a starter. And so, but what I witnessed prior to my pitching there, I could not really believe that anybody could treat another human being like he was treated. And I'm sure some of you have probably seen 42, you know. That depicts some of it. It was worse. It was worse than what you saw. And believe me, I saw it all. I saw a guy sliding into second. I saw him sliding into second base. I saw the guy covering second base spit on him and then call him everything in the book. And he stood there or laid there and took it. And to have somebody do that and abuse him in such a way that is just, you know, it's beyond imagination in your own mind unless you're there to see it. You could probably feel a lot like I did when I saw that, because with my background and everything, and living in an area where things like that just didn't happen. You don't treat people like that. It just hurts your heart. And I can remember in pitching that particular game, Jackie bunted one down first base, and I was able to get the ball and tag him. I didn't knock him over or anything like that, but in the process of him trying to dodge me, he did hit the ground, but it was not because I knocked him down, but I did tag him out. And you could see the hurt in his eyes, you know, and even some of the guys on the bench, people in the stands, the things that they would throw at him and so on, and holler at him, you know, to tell him, you know, they'd call him, you black so-and-so, why don't you go get out of here? We don't need you, and those kinds of things. Well, baseball did need Jackie because he certainly opened the door and improved the game. He was a great player, a very intelligent person. He graduated with honors. He served in the armed services. And I think he was a lieutenant, because of his knowledge and his skills that he had in working with people and so forth. He was one of the greatest guys that I ever knew and learned about and respect and love for the kind of person he was. And you learn those things about individual players as you get to know them. And it wasn't long, you know, that first of all, the Dodgers, matter of fact, the Dodger players signed a petition, all except Pee Wee Reese. They signed a petition and that they would not take the field with Jackie Robinson. Well, Branch Rickey met with the players and says, well, you can either play or you can go home, one or the other. You know, and get out of baseball because we're playing this game. You better be in it. And if you're not, you know, then some other things are going to happen to you other than you're not going to be playing baseball here in Brooklyn.
McKett, you came to the majors almost exactly a decade after Jackie Robinson. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about some of the racism you faced in the Cleveland Indians organization and in Major League Baseball.
Well, it was that way pretty much. Up until 60, Civil Rights Bill was passed in 66, 65, somewhere. So actually we all went through primarily the same thing that Jackie and Larry Doby went through. I got to the major leagues in 1958 and we could not stay at the same hotel as the rest of the ball players. In Kansas City, we could not stay in Missouri with the rest of the ball players, so we had to stay across the river in Kansas. We couldn't stay at the same hotel in Baltimore, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. That was rough for a while because we were talking about Virginia and we were talking about Maryland, and so forth. And we got threatened phone calls just like Jackie did. And the threatening phone call, of course, was death. If you show up, you're not going to make it. You're going to get shot and so forth and so on. That's just simply the way it was. You had to take it. We didn't take it really psychologically, but physically we had to take it because that's the way that it was. But thank goodness, because of your faith, you didn't let the same thing happen to you in terms of the people that was ridiculing you. Mom always taught us, Mom believed in the Ten Commandments, and she she used to tell me all the time, says, you know, no matter what they may say, or non-believers, she said, there's nothing wrong with the Ten Commandments. And I think that's what happened to a lot of us that was ridiculed and that was treated the way that were treated, is that you don't become like them in terms of hatred. You must always, those people that hate you need more support than the strength than you have.
When you were in the minor leagues, you met a Viennese model. Her name was Trudy.
Yeah.
Tell us a story about that.
Well, Trudy, my darling. Trudy.
Tell us the first story.
Okay.
How did that story start out?
Okay. He knows the story. He's getting me in trouble now because he's going to go back and tell her. Yeah, he's going to go back and tell her. No, no. In 1957, I fell in love, and the person that I fell in love with happened to be Caucasian, white. And so I told Trudy after falling in love with her, I says, we're going to get married. Well, the Cleveland Indians at that time told me that there was no way I was going to get married to a white lady. And if I do get married to a white lady, I would not be in the major leagues, because I was in the minor leagues at that time. And but I was adamant about it. I told Trudy, I said, Trudy, let's go to Mexico and get married. And so she says, no, because if you marry me, you will not get to the major leagues. And we're going to be sitting up watching TV one night, and all of those players that you played with are going to be in the big leagues, and you're going to look at me, and you're going to say, if it wasn't for you, I would be in the major leagues. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. But anyway, we didn't get married until a few years later, and we did get married. And we've been married ever since. And wonderful lady. And she talked with this funny accent. They, what are you doing? That's what she says. But anyway, that's the story and we've been happily married now for over 50, close to 50 years or something like that. That's the way it was. But the real story, and everybody remember Ted Williams, right? Ted Williams was something, you know, like the deacon here. But in New Orleans, we could not stay in the hotels in New Orleans either. And what they would do is that when we flew in, they would make sure that we were put out of the airport as soon as they possibly could. They had a little stand across the street from the airport in New Orleans. And they made sure that you got on that little hilly on that stand and waited for a black taxi cab to come and pick you up. Now, we couldn't stay with our teammates, and we couldn't ride in the cabs with our tournaments. I mean, with our teammates. And so what they would do is that they would take our bags and put them on the bus with the white players, and they would take them to the hotel. Well, then what you had to do was that we had to pull straws as to who was going to go to the hotel to get the bags, because they didn't want you at the hotel either. And I didn't lose the straws that much, but I lost it this time. So now we had four African Americans on the team. That's four bags I got to pick up. We had to pay the black taxi cab a lot of money just to go up to that hotel. And this one time, when I got to the hotel, the guys out front, doorman and stuff like that, first thing they said, what are you doing here? I said, well, see those bags over there in the lobby? Those bags belong to the African-American players on the Boston Red Sox and on the Cleveland. And they said, that's a lot of stores. you know, you ain't got no bags in here. And it just so happened that Ted Williams was coming back from dinner, and because this is about an hour later. So he looked at me. He said, "Hey, Mudcatcher, how you doing?" I said, "Ted, I'm doing pretty good, but I got a problem." He said, "What is the problem?" I said, "Well, you know, we can't stay here at the hotel." He said, "Yeah, you know, and it's a shame you can't stay here." I said, "But I got another problem." He said, "What is that?" I said, "You see those bags over there? They belong to the Cleveland Indians and your two mates. And this guy won't let me go on and get the bags." So Ted said, "Mudcat," said, "You know what? Say, this guy is right. Say, you shouldn't go and get them bags. He should be going and get them bags." I said, "That's right, boy. Go over there and get them bags." So the cab driver, he's going, prun, prun, prun. So finally we got in the car. Now, it took us about 35, 40 minutes to get to the hotel. To get back to where we were staying as African-Americans, it took us 3 minutes.
Just one quick thing. Do you have something you wanted to open up to questions? Oh, okay. Okay, let me pop a quick story in the process, and then I'll throw it over to you. Just as a quick aside in all of this, you know, you have stories from 1947 to 1957 to 1967 of different issues involving racism in baseball. There's a real quick anecdote, and then I'll hand it over to Michael. So we've been recording a number of players. We went up to the Bay Area a month and a half ago or so to record Dusty Baker and some other guys. And now Dusty Baker's had a 40-year career in Major League Baseball one way or another as a player and as a manager. And so did about 2.5-3 hours of recording oral history with him. And we got done. We're looking at some stuff. And he says, "Hey, come here. I want to show you something." And so go over, and he pulls out onto his pool table some of the racist mail he'd gotten. He pulls out the typical, it's just hand-scrawled racial epithets and all sorts of stuff. And he pulls out another one that's got a picture of a chimpanzee glued onto the front of it. It's got typewritten a long letter about Dusty's the chimpanzee's dad and how embarrassed the monkey is by his father and all of that. I mean, really, really rank stuff. And this would all be of some historical interest, except for the fact that Dusty said, "Oh, no, those were sent to me my last year with the Cincinnati Reds as manager 2 years ago." So the stuff doesn't stop. It's still going on. You just have to know where to find it.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, as Dan just articulated, I mean, even though Jackie Robinson integrated baseball in 1947, it's not like, you know, all of a sudden discrimination is over and nobody harbors, you know, prejudicial views. I was wondering if you can talk about whether you or and Vern about how Jackie, what he had to endure and the reaction that he faced and the way he carried himself through all that. How did that affect, you know, your play and coming in a little bit later, maybe after Jackie and maybe other, how did that affect, you know, your play and also maybe the team dynamics and the locker room to his example?
Okay, well, you know, Jackie, what Jackie went through, it's kind of hard to think it was rougher, but it was rougher because Jackie was protected. They had to protect Jackie, and it was rough for him, there's no doubt about it. But it was much rougher for us coming after him because they, people that was like that and that was threatening to you, they didn't care what happened to you because there was no privacy, there was no guards, there was no protection. You just had to run like hell. That's what happened back in those days with us. And when we saw the movie, I can tell you all the truth. Now, we love Jackie, there's no doubt, and we love Larry Doby. But the stuff that we had to go through after Jackie Robinson was nothing. What Jackie went through, it was rough, but what we had to go through, we just had to keep running because the threats were always there. Threats for death and so forth was always there. The letters that we got was always there. And there were places even in the big leagues that we couldn't stay at. We couldn't find places to stay. We couldn't find places to eat. You go to Arizona for spring training, and you couldn't find anywhere to eat. And you had to read in the newspaper every morning as to what restaurant you could eat at. Because if that restaurant allowed you to eat, there were threats to that restaurant. So that restaurant then had to take the ad out of the paper and put a new ad in as to when you could play. You see, and it was a little bit more, but like we're talking about, not only we're talking about segregation, but we're talking about religion. We're talking about strength. You really needed a religious strength to believe that you weren't going to get shot between your eyes after that point. But nonetheless, them guys were still hitting the ball. We're still pitching. Maybe it was because you didn't want to go back to that lumber mill for 67 cents an hour. And you wanted to make sure that you made a little, instead of making 67 cents an hour, baseball, I think, paid us $1.25 an hour. So, something like that. Yeah, but that's the way it was. And that's why I wrote the book. Because I wanted fans to know that there was more to it, a lot more to it than it was. But again, you can't discount what Jackie went through. But we went through the same thing and much more threatening because we didn't have protection back in those days as it was. Now, I got to add that because we were treated that way didn't mean that we treated people, you know, the same way. No, that didn't happen because we didn't allow that to happen. We didn't want to treat people the same way as the way we were treated. That just didn't seem like the right place to be in that time. We just gutted it out. And you see my gray hair right now. Yeah. But that's okay.
That was Major League Baseball All-Star James Mudcat Grant speaking at a University of Idaho School of Journalism and Mass Media panel at the 1912 Center in Moscow, April 15th. Grant was the first African-American pitcher in American League history to win 20 games in a season. In 1965, he helped the Twins reach the World Series against the Los Angeles Dodgers. Following his playing career, Grant has dedicated himself to studying and promoting the history of African Americans in baseball. He is the author of The Black Aces, Baseball's Only African American 20-Game Winners, published in 2006. You also heard from All-Star and 1960 Cy Young Award-winning pitcher Vern Law, who played 16 seasons for the Pittsburgh Pirates, including the 1960 team that defeated the New York Yankees. Law is an LDS church member who now lives in Ogden, Utah. That's it for this special holiday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP. FP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. All editions of the KRFP Evening Report are archived on the KRFP website after broadcast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great holiday weekend.